And now I do have my guest, Grant Smith, the founder of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East, and director of the remarkable Israel Lobby Archive website. He should be familiar to long-time Takes on the World listeners. He has been my guest on a number of times before, usually after he's written one of his amazing books describing the history of the pro-Israel lobby and the Israeli smuggling of weapons and nuclear materials out of the United States, employing to a large degree declassified U.S. government documents that have been ignored by other political researchers because the topics are politically too hot. Grant's books include Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America, Spy Trade, How Israel's Lobby Undermines America's Economy, Divert, Numek, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons, and two of them that are pertinent to this year's remembrance, 50th anniversary of the 1963 Fulbright hearing, Foreign Agency, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, and America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's battle to register the Israel lobby as agents of a foreign government. Welcome, Grant Smith, once again to Takes on the World.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again, Jeff. I think this show is extremely important. I try to catch as many episodes as possible. And it's just a wonderful service that you're giving.
Well, you're giving a wonderful service. When I read the names of the titles of your books, you actually synthesize what the book is in a very few words, but it's a history of what Israel's doing, which Americans are largely unaware of, about, and if they were aware about, they would be hopping mad. I just played, as you heard, of course, the tape you have on your website of Stuart and the Zet, and we'll get to that in a minute, but the news of the day I want to start off with, because it's pertinent, is President Obama is in Israel for a much-anticipated and what his critics see as a long-delayed trip, whereas we have heard this morning, he has once again expressed his commitment to Israel's security and America's unbreakable connection to Israel and its core values. And I just read Gideon Levy's opinion of core values. One of the reasons I decided to do this interview with you today is to discuss how much relationship has changed between the two countries since John F. Kennedy was our president 50 years ago, and when our politicians and presidents did not feel obligated to grovel at the feet of Israel and its American supporters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's extremely important, I think, to put the Obama visit in a historical context like that. You had mentioned kicking off the show, the latest in what's been a long series of Justice Department failures to take any warranted action on criminal violations. And yet that's been going on repeatedly since the 1940s. And so I think it's extremely important to put that in context. As far as I know, you're the first broadcast outlet to play audio from that video that was released a couple weeks ago. There's been kind of an utter media blackout on revisiting the case and reexamining the case. And if this had been China or Russia or, heavens forbid, Iran that had been paying a U.S. scientist for 10 years, for technical secrets, the FBI would have flipped and run Nozette against the foreign government in question. They wouldn't have hermetically sealed off the investigation and pretended that no secrets, as prosecutor and U.S. Attorney Ron Machen stated publicly, that no secrets had been passed. But they didn't do that. They chose once again, and hopefully we'll talk about at least six or seven examples like this, they chose to subvert the process and pretend that something else was going on, and then stick to their story afterwards. So it's so important that people understand the level of censorship and look at the primary sources, the declassified documents, the things that are accidentally leaked, to form an opinion about what's really going on.
Well, it's interesting that we know there are people in the intelligence departments who do not like our relationship with Israel the way it has worked out, and perhaps the FBI was given parameters in which they could do this job connecting to Zet, but mm-hmm. the obligation was to not bring Israel into it, even though Israel was right in it.
I believe that to be true. I think the Justice Department is the place where a lot of warranted prosecutions go to die, and we've seen that in all sorts of cases, whether it was the early cases of conventional weapons smuggling with strong connections to organizations like the Zionist Organization of America and the Jewish Agency. We saw it in their utter incompetency when the question of nuclear smuggling first arose in 1963, when they first started noticing that a plant which had a former Israeli who had been involved in conventional smuggling, with strong ties to Israel intelligence, opened a plant with two Zionist Organization of America officials and began losing massive quantities of uranium. You see it with the handling of AIPAC espionage cases where they've gotten classified information and used it against the United States in the 70s, 1975, 1984 and 85, 2005, just on and on. You see our fairly credible investigations by the FBI, good interviews, gathering evidence. They take it to the Justice Department and nothing happens.
Well, it's interesting. One of your exposures was in an FBI file. It was that Benjamin Netanyahu was the receiving part of a deal in which nuclear triggers for Israeli nuclear weapons were smuggled to Israel by an American who was working with an Israeli-American in Hollywood. And Netanyahu's name was not redacted by the FBI.
I don't think that was a mistake. I think if they were actually allowed to give a full disclosure of every document like that, we'd get a lot more information like that out. The case you mentioned, of course, was Richard Kelly Smythe, who was in coordination with Arnon Milchan, who's now publicly known as having worked for Israeli intelligence, even though he's a big Hollywood movie producer. Actually working with Netanyahu to violate arms export control laws. And it's particularly relevant because, you know, here we have in Congress right now the precedent or the one of the justifications for changing Israel's status to that of a major ally is that it exercises such tight controls over the movement of weapons and commercial secrets, which is, of course, not the case at all. And so, you know, within some of these files that have come out, you can see how they refute a lot of the public pronouncements. The other kind of grating thing that you see in current pronouncements by Obama and politicians about maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge is the fact that if you ask the follow-up question, which Obama has been asked but never answered, does Israel have nuclear weapons? Because that's certainly a qualitative military edge that nobody else in the region has. They won't answer the question. And so with one hand, they're asking for aid to maintain qualitative military edge based on the idea that Israel only has conventional weapons, when any serious person who's looked at the history knows that Israel has over 200 nuclear weapons, according to Jimmy Carter, 150. And yet these things are treated as though they're not part of the discussion.
Well, it shows the degree to which Israel and its friends in this country control the political dialogue in Washington. When an American president, and it's not just Obama, every American president since John F. Kennedy, who adamantly opposed Israel getting nuclear weapons and was the last president to do so, not a single American president will even acknowledge, even when directly asked, that Israel has nuclear weapons. If this is not power, I don't know what it is. Also, the United States cannot talk to people that Israel and its friends in this country do not want it to talk to. It was once the PLO, now it's Hamas or Hezbollah. We have turned over our foreign policy to a foreign government.
It's really amazing that despite all of that, now there is this grab, which you eloquently documented, to kind of give the trigger to the Israelis so that they decide when, where, and how there might be an attack on Iran, with the contractual obligation of the United States to follow it right in. I don't know of any pact that the U.S. has ever signed or would sign that would confer that sort of outsourced ability to generate a major war in the region. But I think, thank goodness, more people are becoming aware of it since, establishment media isn't the only game in town anymore. But it's horrifying if people are following it.
Well, actually, I thought about the other day what this country would be like if there were no internet and we only had to rely on the mainstream media. We probably would be at war with Iran by now.
I suspect you're right. One of the major reasons for celebration, and people don't see it this way, but one of the major reasons for celebrating the fact that at least two AIPAC officials were indicted for espionage along with a Department of Defense official was that, in fact, what they were trying to do is promote the idea that the United States had already been attacked by Iran in Iraq. And that's the so-called secrets they were leaking to Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post. It was what they were in discussions with their Israeli handlers, and the fact that the FBI investigation quashed that propaganda drive and that information-collecting drive in its tracks was probably the most successful enforcement issue or enforcement in a string of failures up to that point. So the very act of actually getting this thing in front of a grand jury and getting indictments was an accomplishment, but then, of course, the Obama administration didn't allow the actual trial to go ahead. He quashed that virtually as soon as he came into office in 2009 and didn't allow these indictments to take place and see any sort of due process in court.
Well, I want to go back to 63.
Great.
To the hearings of Senator Fulbright, who ended up being one of the first victims of the Israel lobby in Washington and Congress. Most people aren't aware of that. And certainly the hearings, as I mentioned, will not be discussed on any other radio program. I could almost guarantee that. Talk about those hearings and what they revealed.
Certainly. Well, 50 years ago in May, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee opened a series of unprecedented hearings to investigate clandestine activities of foreign agents in the United States. In 1961, the real germ of this investigation was written down in a secret report in which Senate staff of the Foreign Relations Committee expressed their concerns that groups had been organized in the United States to influence and push the United States in directions primarily to promote, as they say, quote, the interests of other states, unquote. What's mentioned twice in the short memo was the Levon affair, or Operation Susanna, which was a little-known Israeli false flag terror attack on U.S. facilities in Egypt, which was designed to keep the United States and other countries in the canal zone, as opposed to pulling out. The Israelis wanted them to stay and thought that by launching these attacks, they could persuade these forces not to leave. Well, they were caught, and it was only gradually made public that they were actually Israeli agents doing this attack on the United States. And so the Senate rightly asks, what else is going on? What else are foreign agents up to? Who are the primary groups in the United States who are constantly lobbying and launching public relations campaigns in the United States for ever more aid and military support? Documented in the files are massive campaigns to discredit Arabs, And so they launched into these investigations, subpoenaed documents, raided the offices of the Jewish Agency, the American Zionist Council, and began calling people to testify publicly. The Senate records of all of this have only recently become fully available, and they show documents that the payment flows to AIPAC's founder, Isaiah Cannon. They document a $30 million propaganda campaign launched over a series of years to plant articles in all sorts of magazines and newspapers, just a very serious clandestine effort to swing U.S. support in Israel's way. And it all resulted in a Justice Department order signed by Robert F. Kennedy ordering the American Zionist Council to begin openly registering as a foreign agent of Israel. The organization fought and fought and fought, but just a couple of weeks after the order, its lobbying division, its unincorporated lobbying division, split off and quietly incorporated in Washington, D.C. in 1963. And that organization is now known as the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. So by staging a reconstitution, all of the efforts made to regulate and create a more open understanding of the payment flows and the public information campaigns was utterly thwarted by this ruse that they had, issued the order, but then, of course, the reconstitution simply moved people and resources into another corporate shell.
Well, the implications of AIPAC, American Zionist Council, and AIPAC not having to register as a foreign agent have been dramatic, to put it mildly.
Right.
Not only do they write the legislation that our senators sign like dogs at a feeding trough, but they created in 1985 something called the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. They call it WINEP, and now it's TWI, the Washington Institute, whose members are able to lobby on Capitol Hill, to testify on Capitol Hill, are quoted every single day in the New York Times on the issues of Iran, Palestine, Syria, without ever being identified as being connected to AIPAC. Perhaps you could talk about. Well, I want to say one more thing. The new Israeli Defense Minister, Moshe Yaalon, when he retired from being his last minister job, he became a fellow with the Washington Institute. It's a revolving door for Israeli generals when they leave the service, and the public does not know this in this country. But let's talk about WINEP a bit.
Yeah, I think WINEP, the case is really interesting because the ubiquitous Martin Indyk in 1985, in 1984, they were caught by the FBI having stolen classified U.S. trade documents from 70 different organizations, from the AFL-CIO to Monsanto, and used it to lobby against organizations that didn't want to extend sort of unilateral trade concessions to Israel. This FBI investigation led directly to the door of the Israeli Minister of Economics. Halpern was his name. And so what you saw was a small group of AIPAC people in the research division split off and form WINEP, incorporated very quietly. There were no significant people on the incorporation papers, and begin sort of reestablishing themselves as this independent group, same donors, office just down the hall, but reestablishes themselves as an independent group that was going to engage in serious research. But, basically, they've been pushing the idea of Iran as a nuclear power virtually forever. They've been strongly promoting ever more largesse for Israeli weapons development. And as you say, they're not portrayed. They've been successful in all of their media appearances to appear as, neutral outside observers. Nobody ever questions, you know, that Dennis Ross, who was the chair of WinUps for so many years, was anything but sort of this disinterested American observer of, you know, what should be the correct policy for the region.
Well, he bounced from Washington over to Israel to become the executive director of the Jewish Center for Public Affairs, Jewish People's Affairs in Israel. It's like there's no ocean between the two countries when it comes to this issue in Washington, and this is never reported in the mainstream media.
No, it's that particular case is fascinating because it was, of course, the Jewish agency that originally provided seed money to the American Zionist Council and to AIPAC's founder. Well, here, you know, even in 2002 to 2009, you have them paying, you know, our supposedly neutral peace processor to work for them over in Israel. You know, again, same money, same people, absolutely no foreign agent reporting, no reporting the flows of funding, no reporting what commitments he's made to the foreign government.
And then he moves from one administration to another, even after he left the Obama administration and went back to WinUp. He has a telephone on his desk, goes directly to the White House.
Right. It's amazing. And I guess probably the most scary thing that's come out of WinUp recently was when their research director, Patrick Claussen, was captured on videotape saying what the U.S. really needs at this point is to make sure an Iranian sub that goes down doesn't come back up, or that some other pretext, some other sort of Gulf of Tonkin incident takes place so that the U.S. can finally get a pretext for war with Iran. I mean, this is the kind of research they do over there, incitement, ideas like that, all under the pretext and as a staid Washington, D.C. think tank that is disinterested in terms of the Israeli government, which they're, of course, not.
And yet, when someone like Claussen says this, it's blanked out not only in the mainstream media, but also in most of the alternative media.
Yes, that story should have had, I think, much longer legs than it did. I believe it was a blogger who picked that up and put out the information, and very, very few alternative media outlets grasped the significance of a supposedly independent American organization calling for a false pretext for war with Iran. And, you know, that's the way it goes.
You know, it's interesting. One of the documents that was revealed in the Fulbright hearings was that the American Zionist Council had its agenda was to penetrate or infiltrate, however you want to describe it, every critical sector of American society to propagandize it for Israel, the minority groups, the black community, the labor unions, and so on. And it succeeded beyond its wildest imagination, but the media was particularly important. Matter of fact, the book Exodus by Leon Uris was an operation Uris was sent over there to do a propaganda book for Israel. You had Marta Gellhorn, the famous journalist who is a lady friend of Hemingway's, and they made a movie about her. She was sent over there and did an article in 1951, I believe it was, for The Atlantic, in which she just trashed the Palestinians who remained. American public doesn't know this, and those people who supposedly speak for the Palestinians never bring these issues up, like they don't bring up the U.S.'s liberty. I mean, this defining act in U.S. Israeli relations. I don't imagine JFK, if he had been president, would have said as Johnson did when the U.S. he called the U.S. planes back from defending liberty. I don't want to embarrass an ally. I don't.
Right. That public relations component, and all the documents are up on the internet now, is a sophisticated public relations plan. The other group that you didn't mention, an all-out effort to penetrate Christian groups and align them with the messaging and get them on board for political action. This is the time that they were unfurling that and realizing the importance of that. The Gellhorn piece really shows they would go to outlets like the Saturday Evening Post, which of course is not a major deal anymore, but they would promise them that they would buy reprints if only they put in the right article. They pitched the articles. They wrote the articles. They subsidized them. It was a sophisticated media effort that was extremely successful, but it really gnawed on people like the senator from Arkansas, J.W. Fulbright, that he was being propagandized with all of this money that was coming in from overseas and that nobody was speaking openly about what they were doing as required by the Foreign Agents Registration Act. You know, the FARA, which was passed in 1938, was supposed to not make it illegal, but make it at least something that was publicly traceable. And none of these groups ever wanted the responsibility, and they still don't. They're awesomely opposed to being open and accountable for the types of publicity campaigns that they're launching and lobbying campaigns. They don't want, as one AIPAC official once said, they don't want their fingerprints on many things. They don't want it traceable back to them.
Now, it's interesting. A number of Arab American groups in the past have tried to get AIPAC, the government, to force AIPAC to register. And you prepared a 365, I believe, page dossier, a document which you brought, and I went there, to the FARA Department of Justice about 4 or 5 years ago, to present the case to the Foreign Agents Registration Act people, why AIPAC should be considered a foreign agent. It was well documented, and in fact, the woman who was in charge of listening to you and her two assistants were very receptive, but down at the end of the table was, let's call him the minder, some guy watching this whole thing who was not particularly or the official part of this meeting, but he was there to kind of cool down Ms. Heather Hunt of the FARA department, because she seemed too receptive to what you were saying about AIPAC, and reminded her that you had to go slow, and then he made a demand that you had to produce someone from AIPAC to admit everything that you had said.
Right. They wanted a witness. They wanted somebody who would come in and deliver some sort of testimony. Which, of course, you know, the four-person team, the four-person group of us who went in there, that was November 3rd of 2009, we were there to inform and to show all of the activities since 1963. It wasn't, and still I don't think is incumbent upon any member of the public who wants to see the Foreign Agents Registration Act enforced to produce witnesses. But you're right. There was a minder from another part of the Justice Department. He must be from the division that, you know, kills any sort of investigation. Maybe that's what the department he was from. But, you know, that discussion, that launched an ongoing discussion. There isn't usually a three-month period that passes that we don't file an update to that original 2009 filing saying, here's another reason, you know, the activities of the AIPAC Jerusalem office, here's another reason why we believe that the FARA order that was issued against the American Zionist Council applies to AIPAC, and here's another reason we believe that you should insist upon getting retroactive filings back to 1963. I think the legal argument's quite strong, and the evidentiary record, you know, based on Justice Department files and FBI dossiers that have been declassified, are extremely compelling. I mean, if you have AIPAC officials receiving stolen U.S. classified trade information from an Israeli economics minister and coordinating a response so that they can get trade passed, I don't know what that is if it's not foreign agency. But to date, they haven't taken any action.
Your book, Spy Trade, revealed the story of how Israel became the first country to have a free trade agreement with the United States. And people talk about how powerful the corporations are. Well, on one side was AIPAC, and the other side was Monsanto, Dow, and similar companies and who were opposed to the pact. And guess who won? AIPAC.
Right. The thing that I think people don't realize, and members of the public, is that this thing was never even positioned as opening a free trade agreement. It was The internal documents were always called the implications of providing duty-free access to Israel. It was always seen by industry as being a one-sided agreement with an insignificant country. When they filed replies, they were saying, free trade, it sounds okay, but do it with a major economy and make sure there are benefits for both sides if you're going to do it at all. And so everybody who was opposed to it just saw it as a giveaway, just another sort of piece of hidden trade or aid. And they were very upset when they found out that all of their proprietary data that they had provided the International Trade Commission had been bundled up, and somehow AIPAC and the Israeli government got their hands on it. Very, very disturbed by that.
The FBI briefly opened an investigation of that, which actually was reported in the Washington Post at the time, but that just,
right.
like everything else with Israel, just disappeared.
Well, the excuse on that one was that because the last person in the trail, Dan Halpern of the Israeli Ministry of Economics, wouldn't give them anything and claim diplomatic immunity, that they couldn't then go on and interview people at the International Trade Commission. There were certainly many suspects over there that they could have followed up with, but again, someone quashed the investigation.
You know, it's not just the AIPAC, but if AIPAC had been forced to register, a number of other American Jewish organizations whose sole existence is defending and protecting Israel would have had to do it as well. We have the Zionist Organization of America, the oldest one, which is far actually to the right of AIPAC.
They
clash with AIPAC and lost its tax-exempt status because it hadn't filed its 990 reports for 3 years.
Right.
And didn't report that to its donors or to its members. It's very quiet about that. but they get away with everything.
Well, the interesting thing about the Zionist Organization of America that wasn't readily apparent was that here you have an organization that's been around and has been a powerhouse back in the 40s. They had 350,000 members. But they were also beholden to a foreign entity, the World Zionist Organization, and the Justice Department also ordered them to register on 7 separate occasions between the late 40s and early 60s. And the organization was able to simply say no. It was able to cut a verbal deal with the Attorney General. It didn't have any statutory basis. And our current inquiries to the Justice Department for why there aren't any FARA reports on file for an entity they ordered to register 7 times have gone unanswered. And so this is a real public interest battle, particularly when you have ZOA executives such as Zalman Shapiro and Ivan Novick, the former president of the ZOA, at the periphery of the New Mekapalo smuggling incidents in which 339 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium mysteriously disappeared from a plant where they were on the board. You know, it's that sort of thing that FARA was designed to thwart by the open registration and declaration of financial flows and foreign ties. And yet, because the Justice Department has always failed to enforce FARA on the most important organizations in this realm, you have disaster after disaster and cover-up after cover-up.
You actually have, in the case of NUMEC, which we've talked about, you wrote a book, Divert, which I do recommend. I interviewed you about that.
Right.
Is they left a polluted area near Allentown, Pennsylvania, which to this day is a, I don't know if it's a Superfund site, but it's close to it.
Right. They've gotten significant funding attached to the defense appropriations to clean up and provide some compensation to members of the public. But I just got a letter from the CIA yesterday refusing to release documents about their investigation of the foreign entities on the other side of the NUMEC affair. And we're talking about documents again from the 1960s, and they will not release anything. Fortunately, there have been people inside the CIA who have leaked documents and who have openly told inquisitive members of the public that NUMEC was an Israeli operation from the beginning. That was the assessment of the CIA Tel Aviv station chief, John Haddon, Another one of them, Carl Duckett, head of operations, confirmed that not only this was not an authorized CIA operation to give the Israelis weapons-grade uranium, but that they detected that the Israelis had assembled weapons long before the Dimona reactor went critical. And so, again, you have this combination of foreign and domestic groups designed or, you know, with the appearance of charities engaged in some extremely disturbing activities, and yet the U.S. government finds it in its interest to continue covering up what they learned about it so many years ago, or covering up what they still retain in their secret vaults.
Grant, we've come to the end of another extraordinary interview with you. How do people get your books? I know they're... we don't encourage people to go to Amazon, although sometimes that's necessary. But if people go to Amazon to ask for your books, then they could find those books and go to their local booksellers and request them, right?
Absolutely. Any bookstore, independent bookstore, with access to the Ingram catalog, which is sort of the industry standard, can certainly look up any of these books by using my last name and middle initial, Grant F. Smith. They're all there. They're all readily available through the Ingram Wholesalers to independent bookstores.
And your website is IRMEP.org, and also for the Israeli Lobby Archive, where these documents that Grant has talked about can be found, is IRMEP.org/ILA.
Right.
Grant Smith, thanks for being our guest today again on Takes on the World. You're doing a tremendous job. I really appreciate it. Everyone should appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.